Many network engineers have been involved in network mergers. That is, your company bought another company, or your company was bought. And now there's got to be this squishy merging of IT staff and network connections and address spaces, firewalls, WAN connections, and all of that stuff. In fact, we talked about network mergers in Packet Pusher's weekly show 234. Now, a less frequent occurrence is the business divestiture. That is, a company you're part of gets rid of some part of the business, selling it off or otherwise separating it from the main body. How does the network engineer deal with that situation? I'm Ethan Banks, your frequent Packet Pusher's host for 6 years now, and Greg Farrow was also here and joining us to share his lessons learned in separating networking one from another is Jeremy Philibin. And Jeremy's been on the show before, so Jeremy, welcome back, and please tell the audience something about yourself.
Thanks, Ethan. So I've been involved in networking for, 20 years or so, and been a guest here for a few times now, I guess mm-hmm. four, I don't know. And I appreciate you inviting me back. My general job is I work day-to-day for an insurance company, but in addition, I do a lot of training around the Cisco Certified Design Expert certification.
All right. Thank you for coming on the show again, Jeremy. And before we get started, one question. Jeremy, what is your take on kittens, for or against?
I am anti-kitten. I hope that's not too controversial for you.
Anti-kitten? Are you a does that mean you're a dog person?
I have a dog. I'm not all that pro-dog, to be honest, but anti-kitten and lukewarm to indifferent on dogs.
So. Okay. This episode of The Weekly Show is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/weeklyshow and use the code weeklyshow30. Well, Jeremy, let's kick off the discussion this way. Can you set up, in general terms, a business divestiture you were a part of?
Sure. So the insurance company I work for actually is the result of a business divestiture. So now it's been 12 years. Genworth Financial came out of the insurance operations of General Electric Corporation. I think most people know about General Electric, large company. They decided that they didn't want to be in the insurance business anymore, and they created a new company out of pieces of itself and sent them off on their way. And I chose at the time to become a part of that new company. So I kind of find it funny because I got to General Electric as the result of a merger. They hired me to merge two companies together, General Electric and a company called Honeywell. And Honeywell, that merger actually ultimately never happened. So I hung around for a couple of years, and then they eventually found a way to get rid of me through a divestiture. So
so you started out as a part of the General Electric networking team then, and before you ended up at Genworth?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Now, there's a lot of tech we're going to talk through here, but one of the things that popped in my head is that there should be I'm imagining there's a pretty strong people aspect of a divestiture project. A lot of stress possibly, and maybe politics playing into it. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that from your experience?
Yeah. So that can often get exciting, and in a way sad because it's the end of a working relationship between at least some aspects of the people you normally work with. So I've been parts of divestitures where we sold off small pieces of the company, and just maybe a single location or a single business unit was divested. But kind of the more significant divestitures often require splitting up resources, almost like a divorce in sorts, right? One company gets one of the two firewall engineers and one of the two WAN engineers, and kind of right on down the line, which it could be some horse trading involved in that, based on skill sets and locations.
Who wants to go, who doesn't want to go, who wants to stay, who wants,
yeah.
It can even be down to like that location's closer to my house.
You're right, and and when you pick, it's nice to be able to pick which side you want to be on, but an uninformed decision might be just as bad as having somebody else choose for you. So sometimes you look back a few years and say, "Man, I made a mistake by staying, or I made a mistake by moving on." Fortunately.
Yeah, I don't know. You always make a mistake by staying, I think. The ultimate thing is that staying with an employer for very long is usually a dead end. You'll find a lot more stimulation and a lot more happiness by moving, changing roles within a company. So I regard quitting a job as also changing roles within it. So if you're a firewall guy, you become a routing person. If you're a routing person, go become a security. Keep changing those jobs and your career will be more exciting and you'll be more interesting to yourself and to the people around you, but also to employers in the long term. And finally, of course, the best way to get ahead is to leave a company and go to the next one.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Greg, because I'm not going to disagree with you, but I have spent about 12 straight years with the same company. I did actually leave for a brief period of time and ultimately went back, which people also say don't ever do, but I'll say it works out from time to time, certainly in my case.
Anything works once, right? In a 16-horse race, one horse wins.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I kind of look at it a different way. I look at it like every year or so, you should evaluate whether this is the right opportunity for you. But I would say that sometimes staying makes sense. And I'm not necessarily defending my record here. It depends on the opportunities that your employer presents to you and whether there's a compelling reason to stay. But I do think it makes a lot of sense to sort of reevaluate that from time to time and make sure it's still a good fit and that there isn't, you know, greener grass somewhere else.
Jeremy, did you have a lot of say in where you were going to end up?
So in this particular divestiture, I did. So I worked for General Electric in the corporate network operations center. Honestly, General Electric goes through these sort of business level divestitures, mergers pretty constantly. And in this particular case, through relationships I had built up with the network manager and others that were involved in the divestiture, they made an interesting offer to have me come. And initially, it was a one-year contract to just set them up and send them on their way, you know, give them sort of structure and their own network design. Ultimately, it made sense for me to stay. And, you know, as I said, I stuck around. But in that case, I did have a choice. So I sort of, in a way, quit Genworth and went out. I'm sorry, quit General Electric and went out on my own with Genworth.
Hmm. I've been a part of some divestitures, mostly from a distance where I, for whatever reason, didn't have to get too involved in the project. But you could, as an outsider looking at a project like that, go just say, why don't you just tell the people you're divesting, here's your drop dead date and be sure to be off the network by then. And good luck with that. Why isn't a divestiture as simple as that?
To some people, maybe they are, right? Especially an accounting person or, you know, high level managers who, you know, see it as a simple operation. What I've found though is in most cases with the divestiture, there's, so let's kind of sort of categorize divestitures in two ways. The type of divestiture you just described is sort of I'm going to call it an autonomous divestiture, which is a made up term by me. So don't use that in business class. But what I mean by that is where a portion of a company becomes wholly independent. So it's just basically spun out or, you know, sold to a company that doesn't do anything else, you know, some sort of private equity firm or a completely, you know, independent company as the result of the divestiture. Those probably do follow a bit the model that you said. The ones that are more complicated and probably more common are when a piece of one company is sold to another company that already operates some amount of IT, for example, for our purposes. And those are the ones that become stickier. What I've found is we usually, you know, when my company goes through this process, we usually sign some sort of agreement. Our internal name for it, I think it comes from GE, is a technical services agreement. But you'll find just about every three-letter acronym used for this sort of idea. And the concept is that for some period of time, the selling company is obligated to provide IT services to the divested company, past the point of sale. Think of things like internet access or remote office, remote VPN or email services or, usually it gets into the applications as well, you know, financial applications or access to previous financial information that's stored in the original company system. So once the divestiture is complete, there's still this extranet connection that probably lingers for quite some period of time. So I don't know if that gets around to your question.
Well, it does.
Usually forever, though. In my experience, it never gets shut down because there just might be something there.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I need something.
Greg, you're talking about a scenario that I'm familiar with, which was a payment processing company getting rid of part of their, basically it was a subsidiary they owned where there was shared data center space, shared circuits in some case, shared access to a lot of resources. And then that company was sold off, became its own thing. And that process took years to move that company to the side or for it to become autonomous, if you will, because of all of the different intricacies and dependencies and, you know, processes. And they had to keep processing. They had customers. They couldn't just, you know, cut everybody over to this new thing, you know, one day. So it took a long time to shift over to the point of eventually, I think there was a drop dead date that was involved. Like, no, seriously, you guys really have to get out of the data center. No, honestly, you do. Kind of thing to kind of push it all along. But it was complicated to be able to keep doing their job while at the same time trying to stand up their own independent infrastructure to make it happen. Keeping business going was the complication there.
Sometimes when these divestitures take place, you know, all of these things are pre-thought out and put into a nice comprehensive document that says, you know, after a certain point in time, there will be an additional charge or a monthly charge to maintain access to previous systems. And then, you know, on a certain date, it doesn't matter. There's no amount of money you can spend to keep that connection up. Other times they are the simplest of documents that say, you know, make it work.
But making it work is hard. I mean, I was thinking through this problem, the challenge of moving all of your stuff to some independent platform. And boy, depending on how you were tied up before, you got categories upon categories of just network related stuff to think about. You know, for example, Jeremy, you can comment on these as we go. Internet connectivity, something as basic as that, especially if you are providing services through that internet presence to customers. You've got firewalls, you've got circuits, just straightforward plumbing. Whatever those public-facing services might be, and then the related infrastructure for them, load balancers and proxies. You got DNS considerations, address space, public address space to consider. Just that alone would be a complicated project.
Yeah, that's an interesting set of topics right there. For example, when we divested portions of our company, you know, we have very specific rules about what website somebody can visit, you know, content filtering and things for outbound services. Those need to be translated or provided to the acquiring company in a format that makes sense for them. And of course, they can choose to reject it if they want. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it was the regulatory requirements that the piece, you know, that business is under that requires them to either have access to certain things in Europe or not have access to certain things, you know, for like data loss prevention purposes. But the one that's most interesting on your list there was probably address space. Right? You know, 10 years ago, what would we do if we divested a company? We'd tell them to go to Aaron or Ripe and get themselves their own provider independent address space and, you know, go on your merry way. That's not really a solution anymore, right? That's certainly on the IPv4 side. Whether you divest a portion of your address space, if you have a /24, you know, you don't really have anything you can divest. Half a /24 is, you know, effectively useless on the internet, right?
Yeah. So, or I know a company who had a /B once, a /16.
Yeah.
And they wanted to separate it, but once you register it, you can't actually split the ownership. And the legal hassle of transferring half of a /17 to either party was just impossible. You get into all sorts of weird things. Yeah,
that's interesting. You show our age too, because I knew exactly what you meant when you said /B or /B, right?
Yep.
I got no idea why I said /B.
But I knew exactly what you meant.
Do you know why? Because that's what we said all throughout the project was /B.
/B, class networking,
just,
right?
Yeah, we needed a shorthand to say, what are we going to do with the /B? Because nobody wanted to say the /169, you know, blah, 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 whatever the address was. I can still remember it, but I'm not going to say it out on the air.
Sure.
Because, you know, security and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, we just called it the /B. Who's going to get the /B? And of course, as soon as I start thinking about it, I dropped into the project lingo of like 10 years ago or something.
Sure. Sure, secret project code words and everything, right? Yeah.
It's more like a PTSD. It's like a post-traumatic stress situation, you know. Everything was so fraught and discussions were so horrible and everybody was pointing the finger and didn't know where their jobs were and the managers were all angry and aggressive. And anyway, long story.
Sure. So I don't know if how interesting it is. But so Class Bs are particularly complicated because that's an ownership situation, right? It's literally owned. So we can compare and contrast to IPv6, where no one owns any IPv6 address space. With IPv4, at least with earlier allocations, the Class As, so General Electric is 3/8, you know, it's a Class A. And with Class Bs, that was an ownership situation where we're in effect ownership of that transferred from Ripe or Aaron to the entity. With provider assigned addressing, you know, there's no ownership, so it's much easier to divvy it up. Although I think with Class Bs now as well, it's become much easier to subdivide that address space. I've not personally had to go through that process with something so large, but I think it's possible now.
You could be right. Things might have changed over time. So.
So internet connectivity was one thing, and we brought up the challenge of address space. What about private WAN infrastructure? Again, thinking back to some scenarios I was in, wow, lots of private lines going all over the place, huge networks connecting up a variety of customers and other networks. Separating would be a really big deal. And again, you got circuits and their related contracts. You got physical routers and so on.
So a lot of the wisdom of this has to come in play before you know about the divestiture and writing things into your carrier contracts to allow for divestitures. One of the ugliest ones is minimum annual commitments, your max with your providers. If you sell half your company and you lose half your circuits, but you have a minimum commitment that doesn't reduce, right? You're going to end up continuing to pay the same amount of money with your carrier that you used to. So you have to have some language in your contracts. And very fortunately for me, I'm not a contracts person. You know, I make sure somebody just knows to put that in there. So in modern networking, it's kind of interesting. In the old days, right, when we had a lot of point-to-point circuits, it was fairly obvious where the point-to-point circuits went. And then in the most modern of days, you know, if we do a lot of internet-based VPN, so a lot of companies I work with now are either fully or moving fully towards internet-based DMVPN or other VPN technologies, but something where each circuit is a discrete item that goes directly to a location. So as long as your divestitures are taking place by location, it's not that bad. Where it does get complicated is around MPLS, you know, L3 VPN or VPLS provided networks or provider provided networks, I guess is what I'm saying. That's where it gets complicated. So I've had several instances where we've divested some subset of the locations that are connected to an L3 VPN network. So the question becomes, you know, how do you actually do that? Right.
You ask the carrier to actually build out a second VRF and begin migrating circuits over to it?
Yep. So that's exactly the process that we went through. Depending on where we were in the contract life, we may be stuck with the physical circuits, but we can subdivide the L3 VPN. And what we found is, you could fairly simply order a new circuit, I'll call it head end circuit or hub circuit for the new VRF, or a lot of carriers will allow you to subdivide an existing circuit. So I have the experience with this as well, where we've in effect split our L3 VPN network in half. And so we also split the hub circuit in half. So two VRFs, if it was fairly modern and it's Ethernet delivered, it's straightforward. You just reframe it with 802.1Q, and VLAN 10 is the previous network, and VLAN 20 is the new network. And of course, we have to then split it off and fire it behind a firewall or something to actually subdivide it once we get there. So we extend the VRF technology into our termination router. So that generally works pretty well. If it's like a serial line, we can use frame relay DELCs. So that probably brings you back, right?
I think.
I haven't seen frame. Are you still using frame relay? I mean, I know financial industries still are, but
no, we've gotten away from it. Financial, so the insurance business and financials are generally some of the last to get off technologies, but the carriers pretty much enforced it or required it by this point.
Yeah, going back 10 years now, they were forcing us to migrate. They said, we are going to shut this frame relay network down by whatever the date was. You need to move.
Right.
And we stood up all new MPLS.
So for virtualizing a serial line, right, something that usually is framed with HDLC or PPP, think of maybe an OC3 or a DS3 or, if you haven't already replaced it with Ethernet, you can virtualize that with frame relay using DELCs.
Just with no carrier dependency, you're saying?
Yeah, it's simply a one-hop frame relay connection. You're just reframing that physical link with frame relay, and what that provides you is the ability to channelize it, right? Or virtualize it, I guess is probably what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. DELCA and DELCB are the two different sub-interfaces, one going to the new company and one going to the existing environment.
But now it becomes a massive tracking project to make sure everything's... And actually, that's going to be what all of this is. All of these things, just a huge... Were you working with a project manager on this kind of stuff, or were you the project manager, you and whatever the engineering team was you worked with?
So in most cases, there's an overall project manager, because there are aspects that have nothing to do with networking, right? HR systems, employee benefits, all these sort of non-technical even. Some of them are technical, access to technical resources, but sort of non-technical things. From the network perspective, it's purely connectivity from my point of view. At most, I guess, firewalls, right? We put our firewalls in and provide access. So I wouldn't be the project manager for the entire project, but for the divestiture, yes. For the network divestiture, I should say.
Yeah, you got sucked into a lot of meetings, I'm imagining, as well.
A lot of meetings. I get to have a lot of input into Microsoft project plans, right?
It's not exciting. Oh, no. Yeah. Well, better that than SharePoint, maybe. I'm not sure which would be the lesser evil there.
Yeah, that's a good point. No, I haven't gotten in too much SharePoint, so.
So we talked about internet stuff, private WAN thoughts, B2B infrastructure. Was that anything unusual for that? Like IPsec tunnels going off to various places, remote VPN access for third parties that need to access the network. Any unusual comments to make there that would be different from what you said about private WAN infrastructure?
So ideally, it's you get lucky and each third party or each extranet connection is specific to either one side or the other of the resulting businesses during that divestiture. A lot of times you don't get lucky, right? In my environment, we have a lot of offshore developments taking place, and those offshore developers develop for both systems from the new company and from the previous company. So in those cases, you have a couple choices, right? You can build new connections and duplicate infrastructure. If it's physical circuits rather than VPN-based delivery, it does take a good bit more time. In fact, what I've found is that the lead time on either new equipment and or circuits is the longest kind of point in that Microsoft project plan. Ordering a new physical circuit, Ethernet-delivered circuits, usually 60 to 90 days minimum. And so if they need to be ordered, that's something that needs to get started very early on in the process.
60 to 90 days, and God help you if they've got to do build out. Yeah,
you're right about that. It could be a lot longer. 60 is a minimum.
What about LAN infrastructure? I mean, because now we're getting into, you've got a new company, or effectively a new company that's been created. You've got to have LAN access for all these people to get on the local network. And if there were shared facilities, now you're separating them. What have you run into there?
Well, so wireless, it can be a friend, right? If you knock people off the physical infrastructure and move them to distinct wireless SSIDs, some sort of, like Cisco wireless line controllers or WCS, that actually helps quite a bit. You can provide isolation by, in effect, tunneling those users back to a specific area. So we've certainly done that in campuses where it's very clear that the majority of that campus is related to one or the other business, but there's a handful of users who you know, found themselves on the wrong side of the fence. The other solution to that is to send them home, tell them to work from home permanently, and that they can VPN in to the proper side of the network, whether it's, you know, new or old company.
In other words, get the separation done just by physically taking them out of that campus where they're the odd man out because of the way the divestiture happened to affect them, and just say you're now a home employee. Congratulations.
Yeah, it happens pretty commonly. The other kind of class of sites are the ones where there's just an even split, right? There's, you know, 500 people in a site and half of them belong and half of them don't. In those cases, unfortunately, from the landlord perspective, it's hard to fix that problem. So what we've done from time to time is we've put in a second wiring closet and rewired half the floor, in effect, put a door in between the two. And eventually it really is two separate facilities, one connected to each location.
That's a costly thing right there, right? There's cabling involved, a lot of termination. I mean, it's a CapEx, it's a sunk cost, but still, it's a really big deal. As divestitures have gone on, have you ever been in a situation where, as the analysis took place to figure out what's this really going to cost us, everybody looked at the complexity and the cost of the project and said, you know, let's just keep everybody together. It was fine the way it was.
It's interesting. No. So I will say no. And the reason is that a lot of times that analysis takes place as part of the due diligence. I've been involved in divestitures where, you sign some sort of agreement that I'm not going to speak about this, and then you're provided a bunch of details about, not quite, somewhere between hypotheticals and details, I guess is probably the way to describe it. Saying, well, if we sold off part of our business that did X, what is the cost going to be?
I've been involved in a few of those meetings. So don't tell anybody about this meeting. But let's say hypothetically, can you give us a list of all the crap we'd have to buy, how long it would take, and so on and so on.
And the thing about those is, you'll do them over and over again and nothing comes of it, and you start to not take it as seriously, or at least the fear is you start to not take it as seriously as you need to. And then the next one you do is the one that they actually move forward with. So they hold you to your numbers. So you got to put your full attention and abilities into each one of those thought exercises, because one of them eventually will be real. Mm.
You talked about access layer, wireless, dealing with SSIDs, change those over, that's straightforward enough. And then in some cases, having to build out actually new wiring closets. Have you also had to build out new distribution and or core layers?
I can't think of an example where I've done that in a campus environment, but where this does get particularly troublesome is in a data center environment. So depending on how the data center is laid out, it's too late now probably, but it's worth mentioning to people that if you build your data centers out functionally, so, there's a VLAN for email servers and a VLAN for, database servers and a VLAN for web servers and on down the line, that's a whole lot harder to separate than if you have VLANs for, business A and business B and business C. There are probably advantages to the original design as well, by function, from maybe a security point of view or just a logical point of view. But where I found probably the bulk of the physical labor, and I don't mean necessarily moving cables, but the effort, level of effort required to separate is when you have a VLAN in a data center that in effect needs to be split, because one or the other sets of servers are going to be readdressed, to some new address space. That can be quite a bit, quite complicated. So I've worked in environments where in effect the divestiture still required data center access. Maybe think of an example, like a managed data center, at least a hands and feet type smart hands data center where your stuff is off site. So it's fairly easy to split up the floor space, but it can be difficult to split it up in a logical point of view.
It just all sounds so depressing.
I'm just thinking of the thing that required the most work for a certain time or contract I did was meetings to select what color coding the cables would have.
Oh, no, you mean two groups getting together and having to commit to green will be for storage and red will be for security and so on.
Yeah, or yellow will be for crossovers and blue will be for normal data. And
oh, my goodness.
I got to the point where I just stopped attending those meetings. I used to think, you know, I used to have to find an excuse for every single one. And then in the end they said, what do you think, Greg? And I said, doesn't really matter. Just colors. Pick one. Let me know when you're done and we'll just take whatever you do. You know, I've given you the list of colors that, you know, of different categories that I think might work, but after that it's up to you. Don't really care. Knock yourselves out. And there was just dead silence in the room, and then and this project manager just looked at me and he went, really? And I went, dude, you're just wasting money. This whole thing is a pointless waste of time. And he went, right, this meeting's done. He said, you and me, 10 minutes on the whiteboard, knocked it out, done. They spent like 10 people in a room for four-hour meetings arguing over different colors, emails. They wasted thousands of dollars, and I knocked it out in 10 minutes. I was just like, whatever.
I worked for a data center manager who nipped that right in the bud. He said, they're all going to be blue. Yeah, but we want – no, they're all going to be blue. You don't think you understand. They're all going to be blue, and they were all blue.
He was on my project.
Yeah. That's what he was.
And that's why to this day blue cables cost more than any other color, right?
I wish that red cables were the fastest.
I thought it was because blue dye was much harder to get. You know, like
– So, Jeremy, what about security infrastructure? And I don't mean firewalls in this case. I mean things like – access control systems and, you know, logging, you know, that kind of higher level security stuff.
Yeah. So that usually falls, in my experience, it falls under that technical services agreement in that one, you know, the original company, the company that's divesting a piece of itself, will continue to provide, you know, say, TACACs or other, you know, security services or logging services, things like distributed denial of service, mitigation tools, and the shop I work at likes is it Q1, I think, is the or Q Radar, I'm sorry, you know, as a SIM, right, to correlate all these things. They'll continue to provide that until the new company is ready to invest in a solution on their own or outsource a solution. Or, you know, in a lot of cases, we're divesting a piece of the business to a company that already has these solutions. It just takes time to integrate the infrastructure with the new company's solutions. So some period of time we sort of manage it. But I'm glad you talked about firewalls, because that's actually a big part of this, right? What I've found is that, it's a whole lot of work to put a firewall between two parts of a business that never had a firewall between them before. Have you guys gone through that process?
You got to figure out who needs to talk to who and figure out in gross detail all the traffic flows that are supposed to be there and punch them through. And it's, you'd start with a firewall that's allowed IP, any, where you're logging everything, then trying to build a list of, okay, all these systems are talking to each other. Does this make sense to you guys? And all the app guys would go, oh, no. And so you're left trying to figure that all out, build a comprehensive rule set and go from there. Just brutal, a brutal amount of work.
Yeah, and with that strategy, what the scariest day is the day you take off the any rule at the bottom,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And hope you knocked it all out. So that...
You gotta love ITIL. Let's make a change, as little change as possible, so the final change you end up with is the biggest, scariest, hairiest, most badass thing that's gonna happen. And if it goes bad, the blast radius is gonna be huge.
Yeah.
But do you know what? It'll be so bad that it'll be good, because you know what? We've spent months working on this and taking all the risk out and making doing everything we can to make sure it doesn't happen. So you know what? Then you go and sit in the meeting and say, "Oh well, too bad."
Yeah. and you put that day off to the very last day in the contract, right?
So, yep.
So you don't,
when there's no money left in the budget to fix it.
No money or time. You know, it's usually the most expensive part of this is the time.
Yeah, because you have to do it because the project has to finish now. Yeah.
So,
no, I never had that happen.
No idea what I'm talking about, right?
No, I've never seen that. I just heard about it.
So that is one strategy, right? Put the firewall in, route through it and permit any at the end and try to select or validate that everything else is allowed. Or another strategy or another aspect of that strategy is to start explicitly denying the things that you know you don't need, you know, the file server access that you know is not needed. What I've seen, and actually what was really effective in, you know, this was, again, many years ago with the Genworth General Electric divestiture, is to build two paths. So the first path is the existing path that permits all, and there's no firewall involved at all. But then use address translation to push everything else to a firewall. So once a resource is identified on one side of the network that needs access to the other, give it an address of some sort, ideally a registered address space so that we don't have to share 10-dot or whatever private IP addressing we use on each side. And then move it over to the firewall by changing DNS so that access to that resource is via that NAT address. Pick 1.1.1.1 if you just for purposes of conversation. And once you update DNS to say, you know, this financial server is accessible via 1.1.1.1 rather than, 10 dot something as before, then all the access to that server will go through the firewall. Mm-hmm. And you've sort of plucked something out of the normal stream and recognized it as something that is needed at the end. The other important point is to document these rules. Document that it's in this agreement and that it actually is necessary, because ultimately, especially in the case of a divestiture, it's basically a short-term third-party connection once the divestiture date takes place. And at some point, you're going to strip out all this access, probably one by one, not a big bang, shut it down on a particular date. But, as the new company has its own solutions to these problems or these resources that you previously needed access from the old mothership, right? We'll pull those rules out or disable them so that, when we do eventually shut this down completely, hopefully there's not much actually left to shut down.
It's extraordinary what gets revealed in the infrastructure anytime you pop a firewall in here. I mean, whether it's divestiture related or not, I recall putting a firewall in for just to improve security between a couple of business segments and found, in this case, it was walling off, if I remember right, a QA dev segment that was supposed to be self-contained. And so we were governing access into and out of that QA dev environment. And as soon as we put that firewall up, all kinds of stuff started breaking, because it turned out developers who lived on a different segment of the network were standing up databases on their personal workstations and running QA against it. And then the firewall was denying that, and so all sorts of things were happening. Why are you guys running SQL on your desktops? You have infrastructure dedicated for this purpose. What are you doing? And it was a whole thing, a long conversation and why people were doing it and all the rest. It's just extraordinary what you find out is really going on in your network when you start to take away that free run of the network and just allowing anything to go everywhere.
Yeah, it's it does reveal a lot, right? A lot of sunlight from a firewall.
Or a lot of things on fire.
Yeah, perhaps so.
And you can never tell if it's the firewall that's breaking something or whether the app is using some hard-coded address or what. It's just impossible.
Yeah, you do find that out a lot with a third-party connection or what ultimately becomes a third-party connection is all that hard-coded stuff that doesn't work any longer.
Yeah, that nobody knew about. Yeah. Because the guy who wrote it left 5 years ago.
Yeah, those are the scariest things, right? It worked when Bill left, so don't touch it. He's not coming back.
Last bit of infrastructure I'll ask you about, Jeremy, is operations-related stuff, like network management systems, or again, logging, maybe used for something other than security. How would you separate those?
It's going to be necessary to basically instantiate new resources at the new company. So if you're a SolarWinds shop and, the new company doesn't, if it's an acquisition, right, an acquisition of a piece of my company, they probably have these things solved in their side. And it may be similar, compatible solutions. It may be other systems, but, in effect, kind of bluntly, I don't really care at that point as long as they have a solution. If it is a new company that's being created, then these things, they need to be created, right?
It's part of your list of, when you get brought into that meeting. So hypothetically, let's say that goes on your list of the things you were going to say this needs to be part of your budget. They're going to have to buy this stuff.
Sure, sure. It also, you know, if you want to look at it a different way, it's an opportunity, right? If there are tools that you use that that you don't particularly like, if you can get them included in that divestiture, right? Generally, money is available to buy the ones that you do want at this point.
That kind of occurred to me. So we're going to divest this company, and I'm probably going to go with the divested side. I am really sure we need brand new big 40 gig switches and the hot rod network management station I've always dreamed of.
I've always wanted to work on that type of route, of this type of router, I wonder. You know, actually, I'm tired of working on that vendor. I would need a new vendor to fit into my resume, you know, and I've never done any BGP. I'm going to use that as my internal IGP this time around just for funds.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity to right some wrongs, or at least to try some new things and see if they make sense.
And then you come out the other side of it going, wish I hadn't have done that. Because it's not that you made any mistakes, it's just you've learned a whole bunch of lessons, that everything's bad.
Yeah, well, experience, right? You're getting more experience, whether it's positive or negative results, right? You've learned something.
We're going to pause the show for just a moment to hear from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. When you go up to their library, you're going to find 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content and new courses added weekly. It truly is high quality. They have a full studio. They integrate their PowerPoint slides, etc. It is extremely well done. The courses are streamed live and on demand, and you can get them anywhere via any device you can imagine, including Chromecast and Roku, Amazon Fire TV, your Apple TV, your PC, your Mac, your mobile device, etc. All right, so what sort of courses do they offer? CompTIA Advanced Security Practitioner is one, CCNP Security, Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, Ethical Hacking, there's several VMware and virtualization-related courses, there's Cryptography, they cover Metasploit, and there's even more than that. You also get with IT Pro TV 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs, and you get Transcender practice exams. The idea is you can practice with the labs, you can work with the Transcender exams, and know when you're truly ready to go take the real exam. All of that comes in for one low monthly subscription price. And if you change your mind, there is a no-hassle cancellation policy. There is also group pricing available. So check out itpro.tv/weeklyshow to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code weeklyshow30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/weeklyshow, use the code weeklyshow30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account. So, Jeremy, maybe we can wrap this up with a more general question. Is there, based on your experience with these sorts of projects, is there like a general template that that we could follow during a project like this?
Internally in my company, we've done a number of divestitures, and we have a bit of a playbook, right, where we go through a process of which systems, I'll put it a different way. We identified the key components of sort of a functional network, right, the internet access, VPN access, security monitoring tools, right, network management tools, those sorts of things, what sort of is a minimum viable network. And in a clean divestiture where a new company is created, it's necessary to make sure that we account for all of those things. And those are, the more straightforward ones. It's the acquisitions that are the complicated parts. I've been a part of acquisitions where the acquiring where we divest a part of our company to another company, and the acquiring company knows exactly what they want. And in fact, there's no sense in handing anything over. They're literally by day one going to have replaced everything with their favorite vendors, their favorite solutions. I've been a part of others where they have no interest in knowing anything about the environment. Think of like a private equity purchaser where they're buying an asset, right? They're not buying a company to integrate with an existing operation. They simply want to hold that asset until it's worth more and then sell it. So they don't want to operate it. They don't want to know what's going on. So they want a turnkey business and anything in between. So unfortunately, you know, a playbook is only as good as, you know, how many situations you cover. But I like to think about it in terms of that minimum viable network. You know, what are the things that are required to make this fully functional? And it's interesting how little we kind of think about that in the day-to-day, because we have an environment that meets needs. You know, there may be kind of bells and whistles that aren't really required, or, you know, the way we solve certain parts of that, maybe some of it may be outsourced, you know, from a network management vendor perspective or so. But to think about it in terms of functions is probably the right way to go.
And you guys said you have a playbook. So in other words, you've got some, you know, a document or general guidelines that you follow when you go through this process to get to that minimum viable network.
Yeah, I think of it more as a checklist than anything else, right? It's a list of items that are necessary to, you know, I don't know, to have a functioning business, right? Extranet connections, internet mm-hmm. connections, you know, wide area network. I mean, it sounds pretty basic when you run down the list, but making sure that you're checking each box as you develop, especially that cost model in sort of that pre-divestiture phase where we're determining whether it makes sense or not. That's an important point or important part, because there's honestly almost nothing worse than providing the wrong figure there, right? And saying, oh, yeah, I forgot something after the deal has been signed. And now, you know, your company is responsible for, you know, coming up with the cash to make them whole. So.
Well, Jeremy Philbin, thanks for coming on the show again. I think we're at the end of this, another Packet Pushers podcast. And Jeremy, you're somewhat social. How can people follow you on the internet?
I've got a blog that I update less frequently than I want to, but I don't know anybody who has a blog who doesn't say that, right? except maybe my friend Russ White. I don't know how he does it, 5-6 updates a day. But my blog is jeremyphilbin.com, pretty straightforward. I'm on Twitter at jphilbin. That's LinkedIn as well. I'm always interested in connecting with people.
And if people are interested in one of your CCDE classes, is that where they would head, jeremyphilbin.com?
Yeah. I just got back from last week teaching my most recent one for students who are taking the exam at the end of May. I think it's May 31st. So good luck to all those students. And to be honest, anybody who's taking that exam. I think my next class is July. So if anybody's interested, definitely hit my website up or reach me on Twitter, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Cool. Greg, any parting thoughts on divestitures?
I'm actually sitting in the corner in a little fetal ball and all these horror stories, because my career over the last 15 years has been one of the people to come into a team and bulk up the team with extra resources. So I've either been the person covering the team skills while the other guy's off, somebody else is off doing the transition, or I've been doing the transition because the in-house team didn't want to do it themselves or wasn't, you know, whatever it is. And every time it's been a rolling just stress and hassle and awfulness, and say, no, nothing to say, just
I know the feeling well, Greg. It is a massive amount of time, right? I mean, in effect, you find we dedicate engineers to this task, and that's literally all they do, you know, and whatever they used to do, you're right, somebody has to backfill or we hire resources to kind of take over the day-to-day role. Yep.
I mean, it's like what Gartner calls bimodal IT, right? This idea that over there is the day-to-day stuff, and then over here is a group of people doing all the really cool stuff. So if you're doing all the really cool stuff, the people who are there hate you because you're doing cool stuff and they're not getting it. And you're going to do all this stuff and then hand it over to them, and they're going to go, we've got no knowledge, we don't know how it works, it's all got to be documented, blah, blah, blah. Or you're back at, you know, and then you're doing all this change, creating more and more work for the people left behind. You know, there's no win, and it's a horror story because the project managers don't know what they're doing. The executive managers, they don't know what they're doing because everything's changing for them too. The project managers are trying to keep under control. It's just, and they never resource it with quite enough people. There's always a gap, and there's so much resistance to getting something. Everything pushes back against you, doesn't it? Everything just says, don't do it now. Not today. Something important's happening, you know, or the CEO's flying in, so we can't make any changes for a week. And you're like, what?
doesn't change the deadline though.
The deadline doesn't change. Just because it's the CEO's fault for making this happen, you know.
Ethan, I think this is the saddest I've ever heard Greg at the Pack of Pushers podcast. So.
Gregory, you're not in a fetal ball weeping. How can people follow you on the internet?
Well, they can follow me on my blog at etherealmind.com, where I often whine and complain about these types of things, and also send out bitchy, snarky tweets on the Twitter as at etherealmind and a range of other fine social media outlets.
I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog, and you can find most of my deeper thinking about networking and current stuff on The Hot Aisle, which is my newsletter, which you can subscribe to from EthanCBanks.com. Thank you for listening to Packet Pushers today. Now go tell the boss how extraordinary she is, all the while being sure not to break wind in her cube. You can find this and many more free technical podcasts for engineers, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.